We have a few more folks just joining us. If you could enter your name and your organization in the chat, we'd appreciate it. Again, welcome to our session series number two called Data Collection. We welcome everybody. The purpose of this session is to provide resources on the importance of data and data collection and utilizing that data effectively to support a successful grant application. Why is data important? Data is crucial in crafting a grant narrative, a need statement, and evaluation. Data provides concrete evidence to support your claims. It demonstrates the scale and urgency of the problem you're addressing. It builds credibility with the funders, to those you're applying for funds for. And it also convinces funders that your proposed project will have a significant and measurable impact, making your proposal more persuasive and likely to be funded. Including specific data in your grant application can strengthen your argument, making your application more compelling by demonstrating the extent of the need you propose to alleviate and your value of your program. You want to make your grant application readable, relatable, and persuasive to your readers. Data reporting enables you to make accurate forecasts based on historical data and trends. By analyzing past performance, you can identify patterns and make informed projections about future outcomes. Ultimately, data improves quality and helps make informed decisions. With that, I will turn it over to Andrea.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Andrea Pineda, the Nonprofit Grant Support Specialist. Happy to be here. As Barb mentioned, data is not just data can be used to strengthen your grant request during the pre-award phase of the grant process. It's not just used for the evaluation component. Data can be used for planning. It could be used to identify a problem that can be potentially be mitigated using grant funds. It can define a problem. Data can help illuminate the population you intend to serve and the efficacy of the approach you intend to use. It informs your proposed goals and objectives. Data provides concrete support for identifying clear and concise goals and objectives. Next slide. Why do funders need data? To reiterate slide three, data can provide evidence that the programmatic outcomes are in alignment between both the organization and the funder. It can serve as evidence that the services your organization provides are needed. Data can illustrate the depth and the breadth of the work your organization does. It provides evidence that the program is effective and it works. Data also provides justification for the cost associated with the program implementation, which ultimately helps increase the likelihood that you will secure the funding you're requesting. And during the reporting phase, it validates the funder's decision to award you those funds. Next slide. Why is data most effective for telling your story? Whether you're proposing work or reporting on work that you have already accomplished, data storytelling holds the audience's attention better than simple words and statistics. It also provides a way to get your point across quickly. Using data to lay the foundation of your story means that the insight you're sharing has come from facts you've gathered. It establishes credibility with your claims. It can help you get to your point. It can help you get to your main point. Your main point should focus on an overarching insight you've gleaned from those facts and should not confuse the audience with too many extraneous details. It can help your audience focus on the explanation so that it's understandable to the listener. Rather than just describing the issue, you're providing insight into the issue, how you came up with that information. In other words, how and why, rather than just the who, what, when, and where. Lastly, you should sequence your data in a linear manner. introducing data points in a sequential fashion and letting them build support for your overarching insight. Data can be categorized into either quantitative or qualitative data. Qualitative data can be used to enrich context and detailed insights into the needs, experiences, and perspectives of the population you are serving, allowing you to craft a more compelling and impactful proposal by illustrating the why behind the problem and the nuances of the situation beyond just statistics. For example, qualitative data can include client testimonials, staff observations, or success stories. Quantitative data explains the depth of the issue your work is aiming to respond to in your storytelling. These are specific numbers to support your needs statement, program description, or the outcomes. Examples of quantitative data include the number of clients you've served, or the percentage of population below the poverty level, et cetera, et cetera. And with that, I'm going to pass it along to Megan.
Hi, all. I'm Megan Cox, Division Manager for Grants Internal Audit and Financial Analysis here at Loudoun County. And we are going to give you an example now of what Andrea just described in terms of qualitative and quantitative evidence, and really how to back up your claims for your proposal pre-award. So this example is coming from a Loudoun County application when we applied for the Virginia Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Grant about a year and a half ago. So next slide, Barb. And if you want to go ahead and throw the arrows up too, that would be good. So as you see here, what we have in terms of the arrows related to the paragraphs are claims that Loudoun County is making, that we have a sequential order. Since 2012, Loudoun County Public Schools has been building restorative practices program. So we are providing some of that background and has, you know, a 10-year evidence-based intervention that they've been working on for the county's public school systems. The second paragraph provides evidence for the intervention itself. So these restorative practice interventions have been proven to reduce disproportional suspension rates. These data can come from existing research, so you can actually find them via a Google Scholar search. You can look at several scholarly articles to find evidence for the claims that you are stating. But essentially, the claim is that these interventions have been proven to work. Without data to back that up, it's just a claim. There's nothing to substantiate it. So that's what we are thinking about when we are saying data is needed to back up a claim. When we look at existing data, the interventions, as I mentioned, can come from existing journal articles, but it can also come from your own data, which is in the third paragraph. For the project, the service will be available to all students, but they are specifically focused for 21-22 on 441 students. So they're using their own data to help provide this background and this story for why they think it's important. In the first paragraph, they're saying, we know how to do this. It's been proven through other studies, and now we want to continue the work. So when Andrea mentioned the how, the why, this really does lay it out well. And then for the third bullet, the what. Next slide, please. So we do have a couple more examples here where we're talking about quantitative and qualitative data. Qualitative data could be interview data. It could be, as Andrea mentioned, a specific story. Stories are very compelling. Success cases are very compelling. When coupled with quantitative data, they really do paint the whole picture. And so what we're looking at here is that researchers have noted suspensions and expulsions are being overused, particularly for students of color. That's a claim. We need to have data to back it up. These are typical claims that you should be able to substantiate in your proposals and should be able to then use qualitative data to add that color, the personal touch, the why is this important rather than what we are doing and what the data say quantitatively. Next bullet. And so as we were just stating, you know, they did talk about their current interventions, effectiveness. Effectiveness is very important, especially when you're working in human services or the social sciences or economic development. What has been proven to be effective is something that you really need to pay attention to. The quantitative data can help you determine effectiveness and efficiency. And qualitative data can provide the necessary context to help build a cohesive proposal. So there's multiple pieces to this, and it becomes an art when you're writing it. Next bullet. And so here again, we have the number of restorative practices conferences that were facilitated in a year has increased. So again, what we're seeing is data over data over data, but it's written in such a way that you are providing your individual organizational data as well as data from existing research. So when we dive into this a little bit further, when we look at the first bullet, the bolded statement there that researchers have noted that an overuse of suspensions and expulsions, there's a specific type of statistic and statistical analysis that accompanies this type of statement and this evidence. So when we think about any kind of relationship or differences between groups, there's a specific methodology, a specific statistical method that is probably in that article in Kim et al. In 2010 that helps us get to that conclusion, and that's called an inferential statistic. We also have descriptive statistics, which is the second black bolded statement in the second arrow. The number of cases has increased from 17 to 134. That's a description of the population that you saw on the last slide. And this is for Loudoun County Public Schools. So there are pieces of information that you can put together that are based in statistics, but made to create that argument. And I'm going to pause there before we go into the statistics portion and see if anybody has any questions. You can either unmute your line or you can add the question to the chat.
There isn't anything in the chat.
Okay. I will just continue on. Next slide, please. Can you go ahead and hit the animation as well, Barb? So one of the pieces that we are looking for, there are going to be three areas that are most frequently used in grant applications. The first is a measure of central tendency. Most people, when you think of statistics, think about a normal curve, which is what is on the screen. A normal curve is simply a bell curve. What it provides you with is that most of the population will fall in the middle of a curve. If you're thinking about, you know, population age or a specific set of incidents at a school, absences, what you will see is the majority of the population sort of sit in this centralized place. So a frequency helps simply describe the percentages. So what we can say is that, you know, adding the 0.3 and 0.3, that roughly 74% of a population is in the middle, right, or within one standard deviation. So we're really talking about percentages and proportions. That is a frequency. It's very simple to think about for your own population, and then we'll show you a data toolkit where you can pull more population statistics later. The mean is also another measure of central tendency. This is the calculated average within your population. So what I mean by that is it may not be the most frequently occurring number or even the exact middle. The mean or the average looks at all of the data points across your population and does not account for extreme high or extreme low. They're all lumped together. Okay, that is where you may see an average that looks a little different than the actual center of your sample, which is called the median. So the median, when you line all of your numbers up sequentially from 0 to 100, the median will be the exact middle of your data. So that's where we often see differences, is between a mean, which is the average, and a median, which is the exact middle of your sample or your population. What we also would consider is the mode. The mode is the most frequently occurring number. We often see this in data that is supportive of specific therapies. So the number, or the mean, let's say, the mean number of times an individual came to a specific therapy session or was receiving case management may be 5. But most frequently, they had 6 sessions. So when you hear most frequently, it often means mode, which is a measure of central tendency. Next slide, please. So this is looking at measures of dispersion, and this is where most of us actually live. We live in a not so neat and tidy world. We live in an area where we are focused on populations who have high needs or who have specific issues that need to be addressed. So they're not going to land in a bell curve. They're not going to look like a normal distribution. So what measures of dispersion and in terms of range and skewness do, provide you with the absolute edges of your population. So for instance, if you had 0 to 100, the range would be 0 to 100 or 99 points of data. So that tells you how broad your data is. The skewness is where people actually fall, not where they probably fall, but where they actually fall in terms of their analysis, assessment, what have you. And as I'd mentioned, most of our work occurs in either a positive skewness or a negative skewness, which means that our population is not going to be 100% in the middle. And so let's see, I think I saw a hand up. I'll pause there for a question.
Yes, I had a question. How do you tell what the normal statistics are? Information.
So in a journal article, is that what you're referring to, or?
Oh no, like if you're writing a proposal, how do you know what the normal statistic, or you just don't? You just give what?
Oh, that's
you
a good question. Yeah. So if I'm hearing you correctly, you have this data, and let's say it's in a human resources or a customer management system. and you are able to pull the data down, let's say, into Excel. Excel is probably one of the most widely used tools for statistics. There are several resources that we can provide you that give you the formulas for each of these. So you could actually take the data that you have from your data sets already, whether that be your customer service management, from data that you just enter into Excel already, and it can provide you with those statistics. Just simply by using a formula and then highlighting and dragging the mouse to the range that you'd want to see. So you can do those on your own. There are also plenty of tutorials that we can provide as well, if that's something of interest to the group, on just basic Excel statistics. That would be something that we can really look into, if that would be helpful. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. It is, and that would be helpful. Thank you.
Okay, sure. All right, Barb, we're moving on to the next slide. Okay, so the last set of statistics that are really typical or most frequently used in grant applications are what's called inferential statistics. And basically, what we think about as statistics are often a subset of a population, right? We almost never have, unless we're the census, a complete picture of the population with whom we wish to work. So what inferential statistics does, instead of saying for the whole population, I'm talking about the need for restorative practices or for a specific set of events to promote inclusivity. What we're saying really is, based on our own data, we are inferring or we are assuming that the population needs this. That's how most of us operate, because we don't serve an entire population. We serve the population that we work with. So hypothesis tests, correlational and trend analysis, and tests of significance are those tests that help you to determine differences between groups. When we look at the slides that we had earlier, one of the claims was that restorative practices have been proven to reduce disproportional suspension rates. So what that means in terms of disproportional suspension rates is that it decreased the number of children of color or students of color suspension rate to a smaller number. So that is considered an inferential statistic. It is likely that they used either a regression analysis or a type of statistical analysis looking at differences, which could be called an analysis of variance, or a t-test. So when we're looking at inferential statistics, really what we are trying to do is discern how our sample is related to each other or to their outcomes, what differences there are between groups. Are there differences between age groups? How do you know who to market to? Excuse me. For instance, if you are holding an event, how do you know who your target market is? Typically, you would think about who you would want to reach, what the outcome of the outreach is, and then in what ways you are going to predict who will show up, right? Using your own data, you can run some inferential statistics in Excel if you have the data in Excel, and then make some educated decisions based on that, based on predicting who you think would be there based on the work that you're doing. Okay, so this really is to show relationships and differences between groups. Are we seeing that some are correlated versus different? If so, how does that translate to the total population? And so those examples are also in the narrative that we provided on RP earlier. Next slide, please. Actually, I'll pause there again. Is there any question? Any other questions? All right. Seeing none, we're going to continue on with what data funders typically look for, and then how we can incorporate that into an application. For funders, what they're really looking for in terms of your data, I like to think of it as a funnel. So when you focus on just your small section of the population, it's really hard for a reviewer who doesn't know your work to understand the context under which you're operating. So when we look at something like an event for to promote cerebral palsy research, for instance, like a walkathon or a 5K. Being able to describe the need in the context of the community is where we want to start. So we would start maybe with national data and provide a couple of sentences on what cerebral palsy rates look like, what the frequency is of those in the community, what the context of cerebral palsy looks like in terms of its relation to other disabilities. Do we typically see co-disabilities, et cetera? So you're providing that context at a national level. Then when you look at that green in the funnel there, that's where you start talking about state and local specific data. So this is where you can look to the state data to support, do we have more children with cerebral palsy in Virginia than Maryland or in the DMV region versus Northwestern United States? What makes it important to the community? And then we focus on our target population in Loudoun County specifically. This is what we see. This is why we're doing this. And that these events that are held typically raise X number of dollars to support interventions and research. So really what we've done is provided a claim with evidence to support it at multiple levels and really show why it's important to focus locally. When we look at the program evaluation data, this is the data that you will be collecting specifically for your project or your sample of the populations. So for instance, as we mentioned before, resources and inputs are specific conditions that you need, the necessary conditions for success to make sure that you can actually complete your activities. And those activities within a grant are going to be directly related to your outputs. So if we continue on with the example of a 5K or a walkathon, you know, you would need to include activities such as outreach to media, volunteer signups. You would need community partnerships, likely with other organizations. All of those would be activities. The outputs would be the direct relation to those other activities. And then outcomes, a logic model, we'll talk about that in the following slides. When we talk about evidence-based research, there is so much data out there that you can use that is specific to national, state, local, and very small sample data. And evidence-based research really is the focus on an intervention's effectiveness and efficiency. So the way we would determine an intervention is it's an impact or some sort of activity that helps to support the growth in a positive direction for specific populations, right? So it's something that is not status quo. All right, we'll go to the next slide. And do we have any questions?
Megan, there was a question in the chat. Okay. Can you make a model of a successful grant proposal available incorporating most of your presentation elements?
I think we can do that.
Yes. Okay.
And the added point is you can always make the model grant If you want to make the Moral Ground proposal available, I guess you have to remove all the specific data related to the grant recipient. That's natural, I think.
Yes, and and it would be dependent on the type of grant that you're looking for, right? There are grants specific to capital and infrastructure proposals for actually building buildings or, you know, maintaining roads. There are some that are human service oriented, economic development oriented. Right.
Economic development, exactly. It's the social development. It's a development related objective, foundation. It's actually water, digging boreholes. So.
Right. Yes. So we can talk through that and see if there's something that we have already put together based on our data here at the county.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a good presentation. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Good.
And another question. If you have limited space in an application, is it okay to leave out research and focus on local need and your program?
That's a great question. I would say read the notice of funding opportunity. If the organization that is the funding agent is focused on local needs and local action, then I think it's okay to decrease the amount of claims, you know, national claims, and focus on local claims, as long as you have the data to support it from your program or from local sources. If they are more of a national organization or national funder, you may want to think about how to incorporate either one claim with multiple statistics or ways to write a narrative that focuses on your program's statistics and relate that to the local need. So yeah, there are many different ways that you can determine what would be the best solution, but first is looking at that funder and where their focus is.
Thank you.
So next is just a logic model sample. We did get some recommendations or some suggestions on what a logic model would look like. This is a very simple logic model that our team put together at the beginning of the American Rescue Plan Act a few years back. Because it was such a large amount of money, we needed to have a roadmap that helps to determine what we need to evaluate, how we are looking at our inputs, how we are looking at our outputs and activities. So really, this just shows you an illustration of the data that we are collecting. So just starting with what our post-ARPA impact is, you know, what we are looking to do when we're focused on the outcomes is making sure that there is increased organizational stability within nonprofit organizations. That was something that was very important for the county. Also that many of our nonprofit partners would report that there are enhanced service models now with other revenue sources. So that's one of the purpose of this activity, right, is to get us to that end goal of additional revenue for organizations that are non-government organizations. We also then focused on residents reporting sustained well-being. And that could be employment, that could be quality of life, that could be that their children have educational opportunities that maybe they hadn't had prior. And that we are looking to see a decrease, as a result of some of the services that have been provided. We are looking to see similar service levels and requests to pre-COVID. That was a long shot, but it is in our model because, again, you're anticipating these outcomes, but you also have to be sure to measure what those are based on your activities. So when we look at our activities that help to support this long-term outcome, we're looking at competitive funding opportunities for nonprofits, that county staff will work with nonprofits on priority programs, that we will monitor quarterly progress, that, you know, one of the big pieces is that our nonprofit organizations distribute direct assistance to residents. That was a huge component of ARPA when we were looking at Tranche 2 dollars, is how can we get the direct assistance to residents? And that is through our non-governmental organizations. And so then we are asking for outputs. And so you see the outputs here as the number that is directly related to an activity. And then we have outcomes in the short term and midterm. So I won't go through all of those in depth just in terms of time, but I did want to provide you with a couple of samples. So we can go to the next slide. And here is another sample just using the restorative practice example of a logic model. Again, very simple. It's just something that helps to provide that illustrative map and illustrate the program as you see it unfolding, right? So it is how you would determine your outcomes through your action and through your theory of action in a series of if-then statements. If I have these inputs, then these outputs will occur. If I have these outputs and continue, the short-term outcomes should occur. So there's just a lot of if-then when talking about a logic model. And with that, there are some specific data collection methodologies that Andrea is going to walk you through now. We'll just pause really quickly to see if there are any additional questions. All right, then we'll turn it back to Andrea.
Sorry. As Megan mentioned, effective data collection really plays a vital role in informing your organization's strategies and aligning with your organization's mission, as well as during the evaluation process. When preparing your approach to data collection, you want to start by asking yourself the following questions. What does my community need? How should I target my services? Who am I serving? And is my program effective? Is my program making an impact? So this table provides a methodology for preparing for data collection, beginning with the questions I just gave you. For example, understanding the needs of the community you intend to serve helps inform your organization's mission, the design of your programs, and your organization's capacity to do this type of work. You can use several methods to assess the current and critical needs of your community, like a needs assessment. A needs assessment survey collects community feedback on existing gaps in services or available resources. Existing community data. So this data can be collected from a needs assessment that has already been conducted by another organization, or it can be demographic data, which is information that has already been collected and can provide data related to your organization's area of work. An example of this type of publicly available data would be census data. Let's look at the restorative practices example.
Is that the movie star?
Using the restorative practices example, you can use Loudoun County Public Schools data analysis tools. They provide information on the rates of discipline referral numbers, for example. And these are categorized by year and the type of school. So this data can inform and support your program's design. Looking at the last two rows, the questions, is my program effective and is my program making an impact? This helps determine the progress towards your program's benchmarks and your organization's approach to evaluation, as well as the outcomes you expect to achieve. For example, You may collect data through client assessments in the form of pre- and post-surveys to evaluate your program. And a logic model is a great tool to not only visualize your organization's processes, but to assess your programs. Do your inputs and outputs lead to the outcomes you hope to achieve? And does this align with the needs of your community or mission? Similar to solving a math equation where you work backwards to retrace your steps and see if the result you ended up with matches the original math equation, assessing your logic model in this way can help you make sure that the work that you're putting in aligns with the outcomes you are getting. These methodologies not only guide your organization's actions, but also ensure that you're responsive to the needs of those you serve in an accurate and evidence-based manner. And with that, Megan will discuss the data resources that we have. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks, Andrea. So we are going to be looking at one of the resources developed using ARPA funds. The Loudoun County Data Toolkit was developed to support organizations, any non-government organization or even government organization, to focus on data that's readily available, public, and free. So what we've done, let me just share my screen, using the link that will be in the PowerPoint that we'll share, it will take you to the Loudoun County Data Toolkit page, where it describes data management best practice series for some of our training materials, as well as some nonprofit professional development opportunities. You can click on the Data Toolkit. It is a PDF with live links. So the toolkit is organized to look at multiple service areas, specifically categories that meet most of the functional areas that we would consider non-governmental organizations to be pursuing at this time. With the data toolkit, it does come with the categories and definitions. The resources are actually broken out into the categories that you see here. Let me just make this bigger so everyone can see it. So we have categories and data based on arts, culture, budget and demographics, education and the environment, equity and family services, health, housing and economic development, income, safety and tourism, and then some additional resources. We also encourage a feedback form in the case that it is an area where we have missed some official data. And then we also have some appendix resource descriptions that help. Each of the links that you see in the category definitions actually links to a specific area. And so it's easy to navigate in terms of the data itself. So when you look at education and the environment, you will see hyperlinks for national, for state, local, and your evidence-based practices, as we'd mentioned before. So these data are categorized by what is considered raw data or data that you can download and use yourself versus a summary of data. So anything in the data itself, when we start looking at the categories, if you can see, there's an asterisk next to the data sets. That means that there is actual raw data sets that can be downloaded. So when we want to look at something like the environment, we can go to the CDC's Social Vulnerability Index. It is an external link. And of course, it is not found at this time. We have some difficulty with websites being taken down and then being placed back up as a result of some federal funds. So we will be working on that. But what I will say is we can look at, the Data Lab. Hopefully it's up. This is a federal website. And this is the National Center for Education Statistics. As you can see, there are several data sets that you can use. One is a household education information survey, and all of these have raw data sets that are associated with them, which means you could launch these and put them into Excel, excuse me, and conduct your own analysis based on what we talked about with measures of central tendency, hypothesis tests, etc. Or you can use summary data, which they also provide on the Tables Library and Learning Center. So these links are provided by staff. They're updated on a regular basis. This is something that we want to make sure is maintained throughout the length of ARPA, but also maintained for as long as we have the capacity to maintain it. When we're looking at evidence-based practices, you can see that with the EPA, there are health and environmental research online called HERO. Those are practices that support a broad body of evidence. The same thing with the What Works Clearinghouse. Often these clearinghouses or these evidence-based support resources tell you how well an intervention worked, what the efficacy was, what the effectiveness was it efficient, how big were the sample sizes. So it provides you with a lot of data that you can then use either in a national, state, or local context, because there are different sample sizes for which they're reporting. And with that, I'm going to pause to see if there are any questions.
There were a couple in the chat, but we were able to answer them or address them.
Okay, excellent. Well, with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Andrea, and we will finish up the presentation and take any other questions.
Okay. So after receiving your grant award, you should be collecting data throughout the grant period. This data will support the activities, objectives, and outcomes as described in your approved application. This will also be outlined in your grant agreement. If your project was partially funded, the details in your grant agreement are especially important, as the scale of your project's objectives, activities, and outcomes will likely differ from your original application. Reporting from grantees can help both parties measure success, better allocate resources, and make more strategic decisions. Data to report is based on your funded application or grant agreement's outlined performance indicators. It reflects the proposed work described in your approved application or grant agreement. It measures success and the impact resulting from the award, and it ensures adherence to the funded project's activities. It helps demonstrate to the funder that you are in compliance with the guidelines in your grant agreement. And lastly, it provides proof of the community need and the additional gaps that need to be filled. Next slide, please. Using the Restorative Practices project example, I'm going to discuss the types of qualitative and quantitative data that can be collected and shared with funders through reports. These are known as performance indicators. Quantitative data can look like, click please. Some examples of quantitative data when using the restorative practices example would be the number of students with active cases or the number of conferences that have been completed, the number of suspensions or expulsions at the start of the program and at the end of the grant period. This is particularly useful when demonstrating the success of your program approach. Qualitative data can be in the form of parent or student testimonials or success stories. observations made by program facilitators, and any feedback provided by teachers. The methods to retrieve this type of data are outlined in your program description and should be used when reporting on this. So some of these tools to measure this type of data can include surveys, pre and post tests, in-person feedback, or you can use data that's been collected through case management software. So all these types of tools can be used to evaluate your program's success and really tell the funder that the work that you are doing actually is impactful and could even substantiate your need for future funding. This wraps up our discussion on post-award data collection. And at this time, we'd like to answer any additional questions that you may have. Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions in regards to data collection, data reporting? Feel free to put your question in the chat or raise your hand. I will also note that the recording will be sent to everybody that registered for today's session, along with the slide presentation. And then the links that we provided in the chats will also include that in the email.
We do have one question. Do you have any advice for ensuring accurate data that is collected by a secondary source? That is a fantastic question. So if you were to go on to one of the sites that are publicly available via the toolkit, those data sources are what are determined clean data sources. They have already been checked for accuracy and for their validity related to inferences. If you are getting a secondary data set from another organization, you would certainly want to ask them if this is clean data. If it's not, or they don't know what that is, then what you would want to make sure of is that you have a clear understanding of how the data was collected, the instruments that were used to collect the data. So you would need a copy of the questionnaire, you would need a copy of the information that was provided to participants. You would also need some understanding of how the data were entered. So if it was hand-entered data, it's likely that there's human error that exists or that gets introduced. And it's not by any fault of anyone. It's just that's what happens when you come into data entry. So what you can do are a series of what's called cleaning steps to clean the data. The first is using the instrument that was provided. You need to know how the data were coded. And coding is a technique where you associate a response category, let's use a Likert scale for example, not at all effective to extremely effective. You need to know on a scale of 1 to 5, let's say, was the one extremely ineffective or not effective, or was the one extremely effective, right? So you need to know which numeric codes they used if they did actually code the data. The second thing is to look for any miscodes. And this would be for every question in the questionnaire or every column in your Excel file. You would determine what the range is. You know, we talked about range as being the extreme highest and extreme lowest. If there's anything outside of that range, that's likely a miskey. So that means someone misentered the data. You would need to exclude that data from the analysis. You would just need to either delete it or find the record for that person and resolve it. Then when you look at the secondary sources, you would want to do what's considered some cleaning across categories. So this is going back to, Barb, if you would go back to slide 11. And so what we're looking at is those measures of central tendency. And you can make the assumption that the data that were collected were not collected based on biased information. So for instance, the data collector wasn't only going after people who were very fond of the program or didn't like the program at all. So you have to sort of make that assumption first. And then you can run measures of central tendency to confirm that the data are clean. And what the frequency does in terms of percentages, it gives you a number of responses via response category. So if we're using the 0 to 5 in a categorical way, or 1 to 5, how many people scored a 0? How many people scored a 1? How many people scored a 2, 3, 4, and so on? Does that look right? Or do we see skewness in the data? If so, that's okay, but you just don't want to make assumptions about it. The same thing with the mean and the median. Typically, a mean is going to have the middle number. So if we're on a scale of 0 to 5, it will likely have a 3. So you're looking at that red line in the middle where we have 0 on the curve there. And then there will be some decimal points after. That will give you a sense of what your data is telling you. So for instance, if it's a 3 plus a few decimal points, that means that they probably skewed a little bit to the positive. If it is a 2 and some data, some decimals behind it, that means they probably skewed a little towards the negative. So then you would want to look at your median and mode. When you look at your median and mode, that tells you what the exact middle is and then what the most responded question was. So the most responded question could have, or the most responded answer could have been a 3, which is likely with things like a Likert scale. But the median will be the exact middle, and it won't be fluctuating based on outliers. So you would need to run these for each of your constructs, each of your questions in your data, to make sure that it is in fact clean. Once it's clean, then you can use it as you would as if you'd collected it yourself. That's a great question. I love data cleaning, can you tell? Are there any other questions? All right. Barb, do you want to close us out?
Yep. Seeing no other questions, thank you all for participating in our session 2 with the data collection. We will be following up via email with the link to the recording and other material that we addressed in today's topic. I would like to say our next session is going to be March 7th. Which will primarily focus on our RTOT application process. So we'll go over that application as well as how to apply in our grants management system AmpliFund. So again, thank you for attending. We'll be in touch.
What was the RTOT? I'm sorry, I missed that. The next
session. The Restricted Tourism Occupancy Tax grant application, which will be coming out soon. And we'll be doing a training specifically around that application and that application process on March 7th.
And just a teaser for that, you can go online. We can put this in the chat or in our materials. It is focused on events or initiatives that increase tourism to the area and economic development to the area.
So it's March 7th.
Yes.
What? Was it originally on March 4th? I'm sorry. I thought that I had originally.
It was.
Okay. Yes. And it moved. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, all right. Any other questions? Yes, of course.
So my last question is the issue of a successful grant example. So how do we access that? Is it possible to come to your office and look at the library and find out which one is relevant to my foundation and then maybe get there?
I think what would be the most helpful is to have a conversation with our resident experts, who are Barb and Andrea, and discuss what your foundation is looking for, what the intended outcomes are. We can narrow down our grants. We can also request grants from other organizations. So, for instance, in the federal government, up until recently, we could request funded grant opportunities. Those were public information. If they were not funded, they're not public. So there are little tips and tricks like that that Barb and Andrea can show you.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Of course. All right. With that, have a great afternoon. Thank you.